Workers' Rights Hotline, which I spend a good amount of time on, and people call into our hotline with questions about their issues regarding renters' rights or issues they have with their landlords or just simple questions. And we have a staff of volunteers that we train Oregon landlord-tenant law, and we give them tips and suggestions and sometimes just consoling about how to get through the situation and strategies that they can take. And we also do presentations out in the community, because some groups, you know, the hotline isn't necessarily the best medium for them. It's best if we come to them and talk to them about, just kind of give the whole gamut of, here's what you do to keep your house kind of clean and safe and healthy, and here's what you do to protect your deposit. Here's how the eviction process works if you ever might encounter one of those. And here are some various resources that you might want to look into if you need help with, like, say, rent assistance, or if you feel like you've been discriminated against and stuff like that. And so we also have a website where people can visit and, you know, pretty much get all of the materials that we have, so they can learn on their own if they're not able to call us. And then we do organizing. So we've been organizing with the Safe Housing Project for about 10 years now. And what we've identified with folks is that oftentimes they're living in substandard housing, a lot of repair issues, mold or broken locks or what have you. And so we'll go out to the building and, you know, we hear about them through either our hotline or through community partners. And we'll go out to knock on some doors and do some home visits and talk to the tenants and see what kind of issues they're facing, and ask them, you know, is this something that you want to participate in? It's important that we get their buy-in first before we really dive in deep. And we work with them about educating them about their rights, and then if they want to work together as a group to sign a letter to the landlord talking about the repairs, and if the landlord doesn't respond, then what are the next steps that we take? You know, do we call the inspections program? Do we talk to a lawyer? You know, and we've had pretty good success with that, you know, because it can be really scary as a tenant, especially if you're low income, if you're asking for repairs and you feel like the landlord might, you know, raise your rent or retaliate in some way, or if you're facing discrimination and you don't really know what to do about it. And so working together as a group really helps kind of break down that isolation and make tenants feel empowered so they can work together as a group and meet their neighbors and kind of pass on that community, you know, power in order to get those repairs done. And we have a pretty good success record with that. And then we also do advocacy. And so, you know, at the local level, we'll work with the city to advocate for more affordable housing, and also to make sure that inspections program is running well and well-funded and doing what it needs to do the community, because oftentimes it's the only resource that tenants have to be able to defend their rights. And so we work with a number of groups locally, like the Healthy Homes Coalition, just as a group that kind of advocates, you know, how do we ensure that tenants especially, but even sometimes homeowners, some people in that group, you know, are living in healthy housing, you know, free of mold and working refrigerators and stoves, and just because, you know, we spend a lot of time in our house, and so if there's any kind of health problems with it, we want to do whatever we can to overcome that. And we also do statewide advocacy. Oregon's kind of unique. It has this thing called the Oregon Landlord Tenant Coalition, where tenants groups and landlords groups come together, and we negotiate changes to the landlord-tenant law, which can be challenging at times, but it's actually, you know, a pretty positive thing, because it means that we're able to actually identify some issues that we might kind of share. And, you know, right, it's consensus. You know, Oregon loves kind of public process, and yeah, yes. And but we come up with I think really good policies, and it gives tenants a good strong voice at the table.
Before we go on to perhaps you can give us that renters hotline phone number and your website.
Yeah, so our website is www.oregoncat, that's OregonCat.org, and our renters rights hotline is 503-288-0130. That's 503-288-0130. And the Renters' Rights Hotline is open on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays from 1 to 5, and Tuesday evenings from 6 to 8.
And if people call and get the recording, about how long is the turnaround?
It depends on where you live. Mm-hmm. We have to prioritize based on which city people's lives in, because it's funding, and we want to make sure we get so many calls in that we have to, in order for us to be most effective, it's best that we kind of geographically prioritize. So if you live in Multnomah County or Washington County, you can expect a call back either that same shift or the next shift.
Okay.
That's kind of can be a tricky part, because we do go lives, you know, we are live sometimes, but we want to make sure that we're trying to serve as many people as possible, and calling people back is, we find, is the best way. And so if people would just leave a message with their number and a brief description of why they're calling, we'll get back to them very quickly.
And then I want to touch back on a couple of things before we move forward. One is you mentioned that you have a good track record working with property owners to renovate it. And I know that property renovation is not cheap.
Mm-hmm.
I guess dynamic is it when you go to talk to a property owner and you point out the obvious, you know?
Sure.
And if they are amenable but they find themselves just not able to do it, or you run into somebody who's just reluctant, how does that process work?
Well, it depends on, because there's a difference between a repair and a renovation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, say repair.
Yeah.
Let's say repair, because that's cheaper.
Right. So there are certain repairs that are required under the Oregon landlord-tenant law.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, broken windows, leaking faucets, leaking roofs, you know, broken ventilations, you know, things that really can affect the health and safety of a tenant, those are required of the landlord to make. And so, you know, and yes, they can be expensive. And, you know, it's, I'm not a landlord and I'm not a homeowner. And I know that, you know, that's can be a really expensive thing. And it's important to kind of keep that maintenance up rather than let it kind of fester. And that's another thing is too, is that the tenant has a responsibility to tell the landlord about a repair so that they don't go unheeded, you know, and unnoticed. And so, you know, we really do our best to let tenants know about their responsibilities, keeping the home clean and healthy on their end, as well as making sure that the landlord is aware of the repairs that need to be made, and the landlord is aware, well, these are your responsibilities, and here is a reasonable timeline for these repairs to be made. And if they're not, then we go, you know, down the road of inspections,
the rest of the process.
Yeah, or, mm-hmm. or talk to a lawyer.
And then in terms of concerns about reprisals or just fear that the landlord may want to basically have a little bit of what is the word I'm searching for?
Retaliation?
Yes, retaliation. It was
right.
A reword.
Yeah.
Retaliation. And I can appreciate that might be a really frightening situation for somebody who is low income or is of immigrant status.
Absolutely.
And so how do you help protect a tenant in that position?
Well, the first thing that, you know, we really emphasize, no matter where we are, no matter who we're talking to, is documentation is really the number one thing you can do to protect yourself. And so if you have a repair that needs to be made, get it in writing, keep a copy for yourself, send it. We usually say first class with a proof of mailing so that you can show, the more that you can show that you've done your part in terms of letting the landlord know about what the issues are, like photos and stuff like that is really great too. Then the more likely you are to be able to protect yourself. That's not 100% foolproof, because retaliation is, you know, technically illegal.
It's illegal, but it happens.
It's really hard to prove.
Mm-hmm.
Really hard to prove. You basically have to say, because I asked for this, then this happened to me, whether it was a rent increase or it was an eviction or mm-hmm. it was a decrease in services. And that connection really, you know, that A equals B, or is really on the tenant to prove. And so if you have language barriers, or if you have cultural barriers, or if you're low income and maybe you don't know how to communicate in the best way, or you lack the resources in order to defend yourself, then that can be a really scary place.
And you provide some assistance in that area.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. So, you know, through a hotline, we just kind of give them the tools that they can take on their own. But if we're organizing, then we'll be there kind of not doing it for the tenants, but helping them lead it and providing them kind of the technical support of here's how you write the letter, here's how you provide good documentation, here's what the law actually says, and you can include that in the letter.
We are speaking this morning with Justin Burry, Interim Director of the Community Alliance of Tenants. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, or email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. Justin, you mentioned that Community Alliance of Tenants are involved in a number of issues and organizing.
Mm-hmm.
One you mentioned may be the most immediate in terms of a tenant has an issue and they might call your hotline.
Sure.
You also mentioned that you are involved in organizing tenants.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? How does that take place?
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, some of our organizing takes place at the buildings themselves, like I was mentioning to you earlier. And, you know, identifying buildings that are facing severe repair issues. But we also have a base of about 2,000 members statewide. And so we do a lot of leadership development and training and just empowering them to not only know about renters' rights issues, but also how to advocate for yourself and how to kind of, you know, maybe how to facilitate a meeting or how to organize your neighbors. And so that's, you know, and we will, if we identify an issue that we need to advocate for, say at City Hall or at Salem, then we'll be working with tenants to teach them how to share their story about why this particular policy or this particular program is needed. And that's a big part of our leadership development as well. Is just, you know, giving tenants the chance to share their voice and you know, speak directly to the people that make decisions, because tenants often, that voice isn't necessarily recognized in a lot of discussions. Or, you know, we'll, for certain tenant leaders, you know, we will say there's a committee out there that we've identified and we've been able to gain a seat on, then we will kind of set the stage and then clear a space for that tenant to participate as part of, you know, a way to make sure there's a tenant voice and get that tenant leader a chance to really develop themselves and empower themselves to share their stories.
Recently, we've seen in certainly in the newspapers about people, particularly in the inner core of Portland, having difficulty keeping their homes,
sure,
or finding affordable housing.
Yes. Yeah.
Is this a new phenomenon? Are things becoming more difficult? How does Portland itself compares to other cities? I know those are slew of questions.
Well, yeah. I mean, Portland has, I think, the second lowest vacancy rate in the nation right now, behind New York.
New York, right.
Yeah, so.
And it's been that way for a while.
Yeah, right? since the recession.
Yes.
And, you know, and a lot of that is because a lot of folks are moving to Oregon. Portland's in the New York Times a lot. People find it, you know, think that it's this utopia place. And they
God
just,
bless them.
And they move here. And it is, right? The secret's out. But, you know, the population of Oregon's pretty small. So any influx of people is going to really put a lot of pressure on housing costs, just because there's a lot of demand. And then especially for renters, because after the recession, there was almost no building of new houses because no one could get any financing.
Well, before the recession, that wasn't that much of There wasn't that much construction of multifamily units, affordable. And when I say affordable, I meant outside of the inflated market rate. Mm-hmm. You weren't finding that much development. What I found is that you had a few apartment complexes being built that might have been intended to be condos,
right,
or they were high-end apartments that were for the young creative population, and they were constructions that got various tax breaks, various amenities, like they would be the first ones to get wired for high-speed internet access, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you weren't finding any of those for the young creatives that, and the old creatives and mm-hmm. the rest of us who already lived here.
Sure.
And so when you had that that big housing bubble break and people were being displaced out of their single family residence, an apartment was the next thing, and there weren't any. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of us were competing. I found myself competing for folks. Even recently, you would look for an apartment, a single room apartment.
Single
might be
bedroom.
Yeah, single bedroom. And you might find something ranging from 400 to maybe 700 square feet for $1,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what happened before the recession was a lot of apartments were getting converted into condos.
Yes.
And so we were able to get some protections kind of in the early 2000s. So tenants at least had some protections when their apartment was going to be converted to condos. And then the recession happened, but a lot of those condos did not revert back to apartments, which happened in other cities. I don't know why it didn't happen here in Portland.
They remained hopeful.
Right. Yeah. And so there was just a lot. And then with the foreclosures, mm-hmm. so there was tons of people that were re-entering the rental market that had been kicked out of their homes. And you didn't have people that were exiting the rental market going into home ownership for a while, just
right.
because the market was just, you know, as it was. And so it just, the market hasn't necessarily responded to the fact that there is just more renters out there on average in terms of in relation to home ownership. And so that's just created a lot of the rent increases along with the population increase, along with the fact that you didn't have a lot of development of new housing after the recession. All those things kind of created a perfect storm where we just don't have enough housing out there really for any income level. You know, it's not certainly the low income folks get pushed out the quickest because, you know, it's kind of bumps up the scale. But even, you know, my wife and I were looking for a apartment a couple years ago, and it took us, you know, it was really, really tough, and we do pretty well, and we weren't looking for much. And so I think, you know, that's certainly the thing that we hear on the Renters' Rights Hotline is rents are going up quickly, really quickly. You know, within the last year, we've heard rent increases of up to $300. And there's no place to turn if you need to move out. And the fear of having to kind of make that jump of, if I have to move out, am I going to find another place, you know, can really exacerbate other problems. Like if the landlord's not making repairs, or if you're feeling like harassed or discriminated against, you don't have that power to leave if there's no other apartment on the other side that you can move to. And so that can create even more pressure on tenants to kind of just live with a unfortunate situation.
Now, I've noticed a lot of building constructing mm-hmm. Within the inner core of
sure.
Portland on Division, on Williams and Mississippi. Lots of apartments are being built. What type of safeguards are there, or are there any safeguards in
yes.
terms of in terms of what type of apartments, whether they are affordable or not,
mm-hmm.
Are there any protections or guarantees when some of these apartment building may include people of various income levels?
There are a few. So I, you know, and I don't know all of the details in terms of all, because there's so many different development programs that are either from the state or from the city, and you know, if there are, for instance, public subsidies involved, then usually at least some of those units are affordable at a certain income level.
Mm-hmm.
people dispute, you know, what we think of as affordable, because it's not just the actual price, but what's, which income level that they're actually targeting. So they kind of segmented it into about four different income levels. Some of them are, they say 30% and below, which is, those are the hardest to house. Those are people that are making less than $15,000 a year and are, you know, either homeless or really close to it. And so those require the deepest subsidies. And then there's kind of other,
you know, for example, like workforce housing.
Yeah, exactly. That's usually, they usually say that's around 80 to 100%. I'm talking about MFI, which is kind of the average income in the area. But when it comes to private development, sometimes there are little hooks that the city creates so they, that the private development has some affordable, is, includes some affordable housing, but it's usually related to a subsidy.
Or a tax credit.
Right, or a tax credit.
Certain types of tax credit
right.
properties.
Mm-hmm. But Oregon is unique in that we don't allow what's called inclusionary zoning. Mm-hmm. And inclusionary zoning is something that is tried around the country where... if a developer is going to build a big complex, there's a requirement to include some affordable housing in that complex in exchange for some incentives like reduced parking minimums, which is another that's another thing, right?
That's another thing altogether.
Right. Or fast track permitting or right. You know, a density bonus and all those kinds of things. So there are, you know, Portland does have a lot of tools that they use well, but there are some tools like inclusionary zoning that are they're not able to use just because there's a statewide ban against it. And it's something that CAT, along with some other groups, have been trying to overturn that ban for a couple of years now. And we're making some progress, but it's going to be, it's kind of a fight.
Hold on, let me do this real quick. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil Prescott and myself, Celeste Carey. If you were here in the metro area, it's 90.7, 91.9 in Hood River. In the Willamette River Valley, 104.3, and on the web, kboo.fm. We're speaking with Justin Berry, and we're discussing the rent is too damn high and some ways that we can both organize to make changes and to protect those who are struggling to maintain their residency. Join us by dialing 503-231-8187, and we'll go to Thomas. Thank you for being patient.
Oh, no worries. Yeah, great program, and it's nice to hear Mr. Berry talking about this Community Alliance of Tenants. It's refreshing to know that people are coming together to get some recourse from the situation here in Portland. I'm a renter, and you know, in the Portland area, and I've got to say, from my perspective, you know, and I think it's great that we take efforts, undertake efforts collectively to right some of these difficult situations that have been spoken about. But on a macro picture, I would have to say we are not winning. You know, what I'm saying here is, you know, the city has this very applaudable and very, I think, very forward-looking growth boundary, which maintains the livability of Portland very much. But also, you know, the side result of that is there's not a lot of construction and growth in housing, and it's plain to see to my eyes what's going on, particularly here on the east side of Portland. Every single last bit of land is being snatched up now and developed, and it's lot, you know, it's luxury lofts, and it's a lot of high dollar stuff. And this is a very desirable. I don't see it, you know, I don't see anything stopping this. There's a finite amount of land. It's desirable. And, you know, both political parties in this country have made a complete withdrawal on the federal level from being behind federal housing. I mean, agencies such as HUD and then the lending, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these have almost completely been transmogrified into the for-profit private model or quasi-private model. And I really think we're going to have an uphill struggle here unless there's some serious change. I don't see a whole lot of backing. No real teeth being put in at the state level and indeed at the municipal and local level to do any kind of real mandate for affordable housing, and it's really lamentable because I don't you know, I think all the gentrification dynamics and so forth, I think we're going to see the situation, if this continues, what we see that down the Bay Area, where the people that do the honest work in the area largely can't
live in the area, right?
So whether that's going to take at some point hypothetically tenants strikes or whatever, I really don't feel good about that. I feel great about things, the small efforts, but, you know, let's face it, Portland is full of slumlording. I'm just going to say it. Yeah, I said it. It's full of slumlording, and everywhere you drive, there's moldy, leaky, torn down apartments, and they're plain to the eye. And I don't want to be a negative here, but I just, if you could address the macro picture, and if there's any role of the federal, you see, or any hope or glimmer of light on the housing, on supporting affordable housing.
You raised some excellent excellent issues there, and I thank you for that. And I don't know which one to pick first. I mean, as far as the urban growth boundary goes, I think that, you know, I can't get into that debate too much. I think there's some debate about whether that makes affordable, you know, housing more or less affordable, or the
or
costs
impossible.
Of sprawl and
yes.
then those kinds of issues. But certainly in terms of the federal retrenchment, that's a huge issue, because it's forced states and cities to kind of backfill some of those programs. Like Section 8 vouchers and some just in general, subsidies for affordable housing and keeping people opportunities to have housing. And I do see some glimmers of hope on the federal level. We've been working to try to fund the National Housing Trust Fund. Originally, I think it was before the crash in 2008, Fannie and Freddie were supposed to be funding that. And they didn't, because they went out of business, essentially. They got taken over by the government, but they haven't made any payments to that. And I do think that there are some efforts to reignite that. But we have a long way to go in terms of having our commitment in terms of getting people housed, whether it's on the federal or state or local level. It needs to kind of happen on all levels. And I can't remember what were the other issues that he was talking about.
Well, he raised multiple issues, but I'm wondering, one of the things I glean from him is how we are, the larger community is discussing the issue of housing. Mm-hmm. So that instead of viewing housing as a human right, sometimes the dynamic changes so that if you are unable to afford a house, somehow you don't deserve it.
Right.
Are we
right.
able to move the discussion from doing something for these poor people who should know better,
right.
To change the dynamic of the debate?
Yeah, and that, I don't know if there's an easy answer to really get to that point. I think that's a cultural shift. I think we've kind of seen housing as an investment and as a thing to buy for so long, and we've kind of lost sight of what it actually does in terms of provides a stable place for people to raise their families, and besides the economic value, what is the social value of that, and why is it important, and how can it help in terms of leading to better health outcomes or better education outcomes? We kind of look at these different issues as in separately, but really the home is kind of where it starts. And so how do you create kind of the political will, but also just the social will to say, let's reevaluate how we look at housing. Is it all about raising values so that the people that own housing benefit, or do we want to make sure that, you know, people can afford it and whoever wants to live somewhere has an opportunity to live there? Now, not everybody is going to be able to live in the Pearl.
Not everybody wants to live in the Pearl. So don't keep duplicating the Pearl mm-hmm. all over the city.
Right.
Yeah. Look, you know, we do have a caller, but I want to put this question here on the stacks. Workforce housing is really significant, and that's something else the caller brought up. And workforce housing, I don't mean just the fact that it's a tax incentive housing, but I mean the fact that you got to have housing where people who work for you can live and not take 2 or 3 hours to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that not a concern for this city that calls itself so progressive?
I don't know.
Why does that keep falling off the plate?
I think that people might have the mindset of, you know, growth first and then you can provide later.
Except that they're not trying to provide.
Right. And,
Did I ask the $64,000
question? Yeah, I mean, if we can get there, then then we'll be, you know, I'll be sleeping much better at night. But I wish that, you know, I think it's not, and it's also not just about housing. It's about making sure that people have a job and are paid well.
Yes.
And so it would be a lot easier instead of having to create, okay, how many dollars do we have to spend on this income group in order to get them housed? And how many dollars do we have to spend on this income group to make sure that they have housing? How about let's make sure that people have a decent wage and so they can provide housing for themselves? So, you know, it is kind of a bigger holistic issue.
Right. And there's even the argue over what's a living wage.
Right.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 503-231-8187. Call in and speak with Justin Burry, who is the interim director of the Community Alliance of Tenants. And we'll go to our next caller, Mitch. Thank you for calling. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. And thank you for having this discussion, because we're coming up on a new month and everyone's scrambling on where's the rent going to come from. So I share some of Celeste's mystification. I'd like to put it down on the max line, where there's been a lot of infill construction. I've never been able, since my company moved me here from California because of the work at will status, and it gives employers greater flexibility in letting go workers. They're not exposed to the kind of just cause proofs. And so, I was brought up here by Wells Fargo, and they let me go when I turned 50. And it was real hard to find employment at 50, but I could never afford to live in Portland, and I found affordable living in Beaverton on the max line, which was great, the idea of infill construction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I got here about 5 years before the economic collapse, in 2004, 2005, and so what I was looking at was tons of startup construction that is now complete in what had all been open land on the max line from Beaverton to Hillsboro. I mean, every day now that I come back, I'm seeing what used to be these wide open pastures are filled up with new multifamily units, and they're not low income, and there's been no job growth. So my question, what mystifies me, is what market force is paying, since there are no jobs where anybody could afford to live in either buy or lease at their leasing costs, on what middle class workers are being paid now?
You have asked a question I wondered myself when I look at this new construction. It's like, who has this job?
Exactly. And at first, when the economic crisis started, I started to see that a lot of those units that were being built, like along 185th and Willow Creek, where the new PCC building went up, I was thinking, I was actually seeing that these were condo units.
Right.
And gradually, they started to switch to lease agreements,
yes.
I would guess, because there was no one that had the deep pockets to be buying.
Exactly.
Or they can get the financing.
So what is the economic engine that has driven the completion and the marketing of these new units?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of the new development now, especially that I see in Inner Portland, is mostly for rent. And that is largely because the vacancy rate is so low and people are willing to pay $800, $1,200 for a studio to live on the Inner East Side.
But the jobs that replaced the jobs that were lost are not going to pay for renting at market rate.
Right, and people are literally just paying more of their income, or they're doubling up.
Or they're not staying there that long.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that nobody talks about. I live in an apartment complex inside of the corridor here, and when I first moved there, my biggest upset was that it wasn't a green building. And for the rent I was paying, I thought I could get better. Now I notice that I'm not the only one that has issues with it, but I see that they have a higher vacancy rate than they like. At one point, they had 5 2-bedroom apartments vacant, and not to mention how many single-bedroom apartments. That's a lot for a quote-unquote nice place. You know, that's because people who have an average job like you and I, they can't afford to stay there, and so it turns over.
And it also points out how this housing crisis issue is not divorced from the issue that, thank God, the Portland Mercury finally put on the front page of a newspaper, which is the minimum wage issue.
Oh, yes.
And what it will take to get to $15, because the 1010, that living in a single-party state, we happen to be in a blue state, which is better than living in a single-party red state. But living in a single-party blue state, you don't find the Democrats needing to be particularly bold about fighting for the working class.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty much paid for by the owners of the working class, not the working class itself, but by the people who own the businesses that want to keep wages low. But the point is I, you know, again, I just don't understand how construction is going to get back up on its feet, how people that own properties can expect to see that they can continue to charge these market rates when all the wages have gone back to 1950s wages. If you remove the inflation, cost of living, people are earning so much less than the middle class has earned since before World War II.
Hey, thank you for raising these
great points,
these important issues, and we'll keep asking the questions, and let's go on to our next caller. Thank you. And you're listening to More Talk Radio. Our guest this morning is Justin Burry, Interim Director of the Community Alliance of Tenants, and we'll go to our next caller. Jan, good morning.
Yes, hello, hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, I would like to say that in the 1970s, when union job holders were affording house, it was low cost, about $30,000, and overnight in mid-70s, prices of houses doubled with no good reason, just overnight. It's a banker's Wall Street. They just decided to double the price. Many people who owned the houses were very happy because they suddenly became rich.
Mm-hmm.
Their houses have doubled. But the problem is their children who wanted to purchase a house instantly became poor because they
right.
needed twice as much money to afford a house. So no one talks about it, but this is rocket, you know. The same thing with cost of rental apartments. We need low cost, high quality, smaller houses, not that huge, humongous houses people got tricked to buy and now they cannot afford to live in. This is racket, just pushing, squeezing money out of the people who are on the house market and the apartment market. This is what I would just like to say. Thank you very much for the program.
Thank you, Jan. Very good points.
What we're hearing is a lot of concern, a lot of anger, and in terms of what we can do. Part of what you do as Community Alliance of Tenants, you mentioned earlier, is in terms of not only hearing people's grievances, but also helping them organize
and advocate.
Do you sense a desire to do more organizing, and are people angry enough so that they're aware and able to get beyond the fear factor?
Yeah, I think that, There have been issues with renters' rights ever since we've been around,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and those issues haven't really changed. Since the beginning, our members have identified three real main issues that they want addressed. That's the lack of affordable housing, the lack of evictions protections, and uninhabitable units. And those three priorities is basically guides most of our work. All those three have kind of changed in terms of impact over the years, but and I would say just recently, within the last 2 years, especially the issue of affordable housing has really risen to the top. And we've had rent control on our radar ever since we've been around. It's also banned at the state level, but it's a really heavy lift. And we've seen just in the last, I would say, even 6 to 8 months, that conversation has people started to say, we can't build our way out of this. So
hey,
what are some
DJ
ways? What are some ways that we can? What are some ways that we can identify, you know, if that is a possibility? Yes. Or, you know, how can we make sure that if we can't build our way out of this, give some renters protections when it comes to how much their rent can go up in a single month? You know, it wouldn't be just like a hard freeze. It would just mm-hmm. be like, well, what's a reasonable amount if you're going from 1 month to the next, how much the rent can go up? And then also evictions protections. And because if a tenant can get evicted for no cause for 30 or 60 days, mm-hmm. that really limits their ability to protect themselves. And because, you know, they have that fear that we were talking about earlier. Yeah. And so those two issues kind of work hand in hand. And so those are some issues that our members have started to really kind of said, this is something that we need to there's an immediacy, mm-hmm. and not just from our members, but from our community partners and kind of the public at large, or what can we do about this? Because, you know, we're in a crisis right now.
How might people become members of Community Alliance of Tenants?
They can call our hotline, and there's a special place for them to leave their name and number, and we'll call them and we'll get them signed up. It's $10 a year, so it's really reasonable. Or they can volunteer for us for 2 hours if the $10 is too high. They can also visit our website. I mentioned earlier, www.oregoncat.org, and click Join Now. And they can, those are the two best ways.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to our next caller. Terri Ann?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning. I wanted to call in because I am recently, I got some help from Community Alliance of Tenants to move. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you for calling.
And I am now a member of Kat. I paid my membership fee. I'm happy to help. This is an issue that's really, really close to my heart because I guess I'm one of those poor people that should know better. I'm not, you know, that I really agree with that. That right. I know you were joking. Mm-hmm. But, I'm a single mom and I've moved like 5 times in the last 2 years.
Oh, gosh. I'm sorry
to
hear that.
I've lived through, like, more slumlords than I care to name. Would love to name them on the radio. but I don't know. That would be, like, slander or something not nice. And I don't do not nice. But I just wanted to say, like, that I think that there's a lot of power in talking about these issues and raising the awareness of them to the community. And knowing, yeah, well, I'm a single mom and I live on a really low income. I am really involved in my community. I work for my daughter's school. I go to school. I volunteer. And, you know, I just want to represent the side of people working to educate themselves and empower themselves and to be a voice for change from the people who need it most.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your work and for your advocacy and for this great testimony. We need more people like you.
Yeah, and yes, she raises a really good point that I don't know if I emphasized enough earlier, is that while we do try to educate the tenants and provide advocacy kind of opportunities, one of my favorite things we do is just create that space where people can kind of talk about the issues that they've been facing and have a sympathetic ear, whether it's from another tenant or if it's from a volunteer on the hotline.
And not feel isolated.
Yeah, or feeling they're blaming themselves for being in this situation and recognizing that there are some bigger issues that, you know, that are leading to that. That is one of the most incredible learning places for me, is to hear those stories. I've been through tons of tenant, you know, landlord hell stories myself, but to also hear it from different perspectives and seeing the people feel empowered when they're even just able to share their story to peers.
Yes.
Absolutely. There's a lot of power in storytelling and sharing, and that's why I called in.
Thank you for sharing.
Well, thank you so much.
I got to go to school now.
Okay. You have a wonderful day.
You too.
And we'll take our next caller.
Good morning, Garrett.
Hi. I actually wanted to address the whole $15 an hour minimum wage thing.
Yes.
I really don't feel that setting dollar amounts for minimum wage is the way to go, because prices will go up, rent will go up, and it'll just get swallowed up. But there is a way to do it that is intelligent and adaptive, and that is to have a mathematical formula that is minimum wage that gets reset quarterly according to prices, so that no matter how much things go up or go down, it will adapt to the economy and adapt to the cost of our living. So that way, we'll never see our minimum wage get swallowed up again.
Okay, well, that's a good proposal, and probably should be discussed more in depth on another program. But thank you for raising those issues about the minimum wage. And we'll go to our next caller. Ben, good morning.
Good morning. My name is Ben, and I live in Loas. I'm retired. I'm 76 years old, and I own my home, or I just about own it, but I really have a lot of empathy for people who are renting and trying to buy. My opinion is that the wealthy people, and I mean very wealthy, I don't mean $1 million, I mean the billionaires, those people and the hedge funds are driving this housing market right now, I believe. And there are a lot of homes out there for real money that are selling. I know the market is heating up, and I think that the people that we've elected, the Oregonians, that we've elected Democrats, should do more for oversight to help the economy. I think we've let people take our economy, and they're not going to give it up until they've got all the marbles.
Mm. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for your thoughts.
Okay.
He mentioned in terms of politics, and you mentioned talking about working in the political arenas. A couple of areas, well, three you mentioned in passing, the federal, state, and local government. You mentioned some of the restrictions in terms of tenants' rights placed by the state.
By the state.
What's happening in the city? Who's the commissioner in charge of housing, and what type of work are you doing in that region?
So the housing commissioner is Dan Saltzman. Mm-hmm. It was Nick Fish for a long time, I don't work as much in the local level. That was our executive director's position, where she kind of focused mostly on the local stuff, and I focused on the state stuff. But you know, there are a number of things that we're working on the local level. Usually, we just try to make sure that with the latest budget cuts that happened in the last 3 years, that we called it the safety net was protected. That was like homelessness services and foreclosure prevention and rent assistance. And some of those safety net things.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're looking into seeing if there might be opportunities for a sustainable source of revenue for housing, because what's happening is at the city level is what they're calling the TIF cliff. The TIF is a financing mechanism that comes from all the urban renewal areas that funds most of our affordable housing in the city.
And what does the TIF stand for?
It stands for tax increment financing. And it's a kind of, you know, policy wonkish concept, but it's just money that's coming in when they redevelop those urban renewal areas. And 30% of that goes to affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
But in the next few years, a lot of that is going to go away just because of the timing of when those urban renewal areas were created. And so there's not going to be much more money for housing after that period. And so we need to find new ways in order to find a more stable kind of revenue source for housing in the city. Because, you know, it used to be just the feds that really provided, I mean, this was a long time ago, but that provided most of the affordable housing. Some of that worked, some of it didn't work so well.
Right.
But the burden of providing for housing has really kind of moved to the state and local level. And so we just need to prioritize those programs so that we can build more, but also preserve more. Because sometimes affordable housing that has like a subsidy attached that might be owned by a private owner, it will be losing its subsidy and that therefore kind of losing its affordability. And so we want to, it's easier to preserve things than build new ones.
Yes.
Or putting in more rent assistance for, you know, just like a voucher, for instance, for renters.
Let me jump in real quick and then we got one more caller. One of the biggest issues I would think would be notice, and it seems like this might be one of the easiest band-aids, would be notice to tenants, current tenants, that a place is up for sale.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've heard repeatedly is I got 30 or 60, if they're lucky, days notice to vacate.
Right.
Is there anything on a local level happening that can help address that and at least give tenants a bigger buffer zone?
Well, you mentioned the 30 and 60.
Mm-hmm.
And that is part of the law. So it depends on how long they've been living there.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they get served the wrong notice. And so it's important for tenants, when they do get a notice like that, to call the hotline to make sure that, A, that notice is correct, and then it was delivered correctly.
Okay.
Because if it wasn't, then they will have some recourse in order to be able to stay there longer.
Okay.
And so usually if you've been living there for more than a year, then you get that 60 days, which is huge. I received a 60-day notice about 2 years ago because they were moving back into the house, which is legitimate. You know, I'm not going to argue with that.
especially if they're broke and need to get back.
Yeah, but if I had to find an apartment and make an application and move in 30 days, I wouldn't have made it. Or I wouldn't have been able to find a decent place because it would have just been like, I'll just take whatever's the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And so that extra notice period really makes a difference. I don't know in terms of if there's anything on the horizon in terms of notifying tenants when a building has been sold. I know that usually there's some kind of notice, but I don't know if it's required.
Okay.
There is if it's like going through a condo conversion or a foreclosure. Tenants do have really good rights when it comes to foreclosure. So if you ever hear about your home being foreclosed on and you're current on rent, please call the hotline because you have some additional protections.
Okay. And, no more calls. Okay. So in closing, first, that phone number for low-tech folks, and then the internet, the URL.
Sure. Our renter's rights hotline is 503-288-0130, and our website is www.oregoncat.org.
We want to thank you, Justin. Justin Burry of the Community Alliance of Tenants for joining us this morning.
Yes.
Also want to thank KBOO volunteer Joe Clements for raising this issue and being an advocate on this. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott.
My name is Celeste Carey, and stay tuned. We have coming up at 9 o'clock the Old Mo Variety Hour, followed by Health Watch, Locus Focus, Air Cascadia, and more. All of this brought to you by you, our neighborhood. Your community connection, KBOO Portland.
Joanne Rand and Jim Page. Together, Rand and Page will pack a Cascadian folk wallop celebrating Rand's new album, Still a Real World, at the Alberta Rose Theater on Tuesday, April 8th at 8 p.m. A portion of the proceeds from this amazing show will benefit KBOO, so you folk fans don't want to miss this one. For more details, go to kboo.fm and check under community events here at your community radio station, KBOO.
Well, I wish I was mold in the ground. I wish I was mold in the ground. If I was mold in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. I wish I was mold in the ground. Well, I'm glad I'm not standing on the top. I'm glad I'm not standing on the top. If I was standing on the top, I'd be sure to fall off. I'm glad I'm not standing on the top. Well, and I don't got much money in my hand. I don't got much money in my hand. But I'm happy as I am, and I don't give a damn. I don't want much money in my hand. Well, I wish I was an elephant. I wish I was an elephant. If I was an elephant, I could stomp that government, and I'd be the happiest man alive. Well, I wish I was a bird in the sky. I wish I was a bird in the sky. If I was a bird in the sky, I could be high all the time, and nobody would pay me any of mine.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, our host and engineer. Through the miracle that is KBOO, a collective of radical leftist agitators, educators, and organizers can bring you interviews about action and issues, politically and socially conscious book and film reviews, and our own special kind of commentary. On today's Old Mole, we'll hear about strikes at Portland State University from Bill Resnick and his guest, Patricia Schecketer. Patricia teaches in the history department and is active in the faculty union. After that, I'm joined by Peter Frace of Jacobin Magazine to talk once again about demanding less work and changing how we think about it. Larry Bold in our book mole reviews a Penelope Lively memoir called Dancing with Ammonites. Larry says that where most other writing he's read on old age is too much about on what is lost, Lively focuses on what is not. And finally, Jan Hocken talks with Grace Sylvia about Rethinking Psychiatry Film Festival coming up in April. Five films will be playing at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland between April 2nd and 30th. And you were listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. You can tune into our show later or again and again by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. In a day or two, today's show will go up and you can share or go back and listen to individual segments. And you can also find us on Facebook or Twitter just by searching for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Before we turn to Bill Resnick and Patricia Schecketer to talk about strikes and the struggle for education-centered education at Portland State University, Fran Michelle is here with a breaking news announcement of molecular proportions.
New element discovered. The heaviest element known to science was recently discovered by investigators at Portland State University, a major U.S. urban research institution. The element, tentatively named administratium, has no protons or electrons and thus has an atomic number of zero. However, it does have one neutron, 125 assistant neutrons, 75 vice neutrons, and 111 assistant vice neutrons, which gives it an atomic mass of 312. These 312 particles are held together by a force that involves the continuous exchange of meson-like particles called morons. Since it has no electrons, administratium is inert. However, it can be detected chemically as it impedes every reaction it comes in contact with. According to the discoverers, a minute amount of administratium causes one reaction to take over 4 days to complete, when it would have normally occurred in less than a second. Administratium has a normal half-life of approximately 3 years, at which time it does not decay, but instead undergoes a reorganization in which assistant neutrons, vice neutrons, and assistant vice neutrons exchange places. Some studies have shown that atomic mass actually increases after each reorganization. Research at other laboratories indicates that administratium occurs naturally in the atmosphere. It tends to concentrate at certain points, such as government agencies, large corporations, universities, and especially statewide university systems. It can usually be found in the newest, best-appointed, and best-maintained buildings. It tends to quickly accumulate to potentially toxic levels.
Patricia Schechter, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
Patricia Schechter teaches history at PSU, Portland State University. She's on the executive council of the PSU chapter of the American Association of University Professors, which is their labor union. Patricia, I know that the unions and contract bargaining now, that the PSU faculty and the PSU administration have very different visions of what a university should be and how it should operate. So, Patricia Schechter, tell us what's happening, why the two sides are so far apart, why the faculty has voted overwhelmingly to strike, if that's necessary, and that would happen fairly soon in the beginning of April. What's at stake in the fight?
Great question, Bill. I'm so glad to be able to talk with you about this. As you mentioned, we've been in bargaining for over 10 months. We have a two-year contract cycle, and this year's really different. This year's really different. The substantive issues concern faculty stability. They concern pay equity, and they concern educator-led education.
When you say educator-led education, you're critiquing the PSU administration and attempts to really take over curriculum, tenure process, hiring.
Well, there's been some shifts. I mean, historically, faculties on university and college campuses in the United States are in charge of curriculum. That's what the Constitution, the faculty constitution, lays out, that we're in charge of the curriculum. There isn't so much a direct challenge to that as indirect. And that happens in a number of ways. You mentioned hiring. For sure, we've seen a trend in the administration away from hiring long-term and tenure-line positions in favor of shorter contract workers whose connection to our classrooms, our students, our departments is much thinner and contingent, which makes all kinds of challenges for delivering the kind of education that students deserve and are paying more and more for.
These contract people also are paid very, very poorly, right? A couple $1,000 a course. Some of them may teach at various schools all over the area, right? They have huge transportation expenses. And furthermore, they don't spend much time at any school.
Sure. You're really describing the situation facing a group of faculty called adjunct, usually called adjunct faculty, who are hired just about by the course as sort of piece workers.
Uh-huh.
AUP represents full-time faculty, but the full-time faculty who are not tenure line, which are increasing percentage of our full-time staff, have similar instability issues. They don't know if they're going to be hired the next year. They do work at a lower, much lower wages and teach a higher course load because that's how their contracts are written. So again, the overall health of the curriculum, the overall accountability of faculty to students becomes compromised when such an important part of our faculty is faced with these very poor working conditions. And that's a big part of what educator-led education means, that we all have the conditions of stability and academic freedom and professionalism to really give students value for what they're, again, increasingly going over in debt to achieve their education.
Full-time faculty can work together on building sort of an integrated curriculum, on talking about students,